Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing tensions in the standoff between Qatar and its neighbours, led by Saudi Arabia, who issued an unrealistically harsh and humiliating set of demands to the tiny Gulf state under an ultimatum that has since passed. And now they are dismissing Qatar's response to their list of demands as the crisis deepens. Marwan Khedi, the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us. An expert on the Arab media, we will discuss how much Egypt's and Saudi Arabia's demand to shut down Qatar-based Al Jazeera is at the heart of this dispute, provoked by Saudi Arabia's belligerent young crown prince, who appears to have bitten off more than he can chew in Yemen and is now threatening war, or at least regime change, in Qatar. Then we'll assess the extent to which Donald Trump's visit to Poland is based on his aversion to protests, which are being planned in Hamburg and London, and his susceptibility to enticements by the authoritarian right-wing Polish leader, whose law and justice government will bus in adoring fans of Trump from the countryside to what they have promised the White House will be, quote, a great patriotic picnic. A former senior advisor with the State Department's policy planning staff, Charles Gatti, a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, joins us to look into what seems more like a mutually beneficial photo op than a diplomatic engagement, particularly since Trump has refused to meet with anyone from Poland's opposition. Then finally, we'll examine the looming crisis following North Korea's long-range missile test, which has essentially called Trump's bluff since he had warned that a test of a North Korean missile that could reach the U.S., quote, is not going to happen. Now that it has happened, we will speak with a former State Department senior analyst, Stephen Norper, senior director of the Korea Society and associate of the Weatherhead Institute and Pacific Forum, and a professor at Columbia University. He joins us to discuss this crisis that, in the absence of diplomacy, could lead to devastating military consequences and civilian casualties. And joining us now is Marwan Khedi, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture, and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Khedi.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks, Marwan. And my sense is that this standoff over Qatar and its neighbors, led by Saudi Arabia and Egypt, obviously they started out with very harsh and unrealistic demands. And then the deadline passed and nothing happened. So in effect, Qatar called the young Saudi crown prince's bluff. And now they're all saying that the reply to these demands is insufficient. So where is this heading? It's certainly not getting any better.
It is not getting any better. Officially, we are in a situation where Kuwait, who is mediating the crisis, because Kuwait and Oman are relatively neutral in this, has officially obtained a two-day extension of the deadline. And the Saudis, the UAE, and Egypt said they will continue the blockade. They will escalate if they need to. So where it's heading, we don't know. But we know what we do know is that there's a sort of two broad coalitions emerging. On the one hand, you have, of course, the Saudis leading the charge with the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, and a few other countries. On the other hand, we have Qatar, which is being supported by Turkey and Iran. Without the Iranian and Turkish support, Qatar would have had to cave, mainly because it's landlocked. Its only land border is with Saudi Arabia. They have food insecurity issues. Commerce will grind to a halt. So the Turks and the Iranians are basically what is allowing Qatar to keep staring down the Saudis.
Well, the Saudi initiative, if that's the right word to put it, is led by clearly by MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's responsible for getting Saudi Arabia into Yemen, where they're bogged down and going nowhere. He seems impetuous and impulsive. There's also a crisis, I believe, within the Saudi royal family itself, with the essentially ousted Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. He's now, I believe, under house arrest. So let's start with internal Saudi politics. Is this the boy king just out of his depth?
Well, you know, this is, I mean, there's a broader context to this, which is sort of a more aggressive Saudi foreign policy that really had to do with the Iranian nuclear deal. The Saudis did feel betrayed by the U.S., and the elevation of the deputy crown prince to crown prince is something that a lot of people have seen, have been talking about, that it's going to happen, but it happened a little too quickly. What we have basically is a situation where there are all kinds of stories and rumors about the dispute within the royal family. It does look, however, so first of all, we need to say that the Saudi court denied that Prince bin Nayef is under house arrest. But clearly there was a power struggle, and it seemed that, at least for the time being, it is settled in favor of the new crown prince. The new crown prince is responsible for defense policy. He's obviously in charge of foreign policy. And he's much, much more aggressive than his predecessors. So there's the engagement in Yemen. There's the new friendship with Mr. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump. So it seems that there are obviously two camps within the royal family in Saudi Arabia, but the new crown prince does seem to be in charge. What is also befuddling is the sort of contradictory statements coming out from Washington. Right. If you follow, I mean, it's not a coincidence that this happened very soon after Mr. Trump visited Saudi Arabia, and obviously it was a fest. If you read the Saudi media, if you follow the Saudi media, they're saying this is the kind of U.S. president we need. They're very resentful at Barack Obama for not having supported the Saudi camp as fully as they wanted to. So there's a sort of a global political situation that is intersecting with a regional geopolitical situation that is leading to all of this.
Well, Marwan, I think you put it politely. I mean, Donald Trump himself more or less crowed about Saudi Arabia following his playbook and going after Qatar. And then on the other hand, you got Rex Tillerson tearing his hair out trying to solve the problem.
Indeed. And Mr. Trump even bragged on Twitter that he's behind, that it was his idea. And a lot of commentators pointed out immediately, he seemed to be unaware when he posted that tweet that the U.S. has a massive military base in Qatar, that there are all kinds of issues that did not enter into the equation before he sent that tweet. But we're still seeing contradictory statements from the U.S. I think the U.S. now is in a wait-and-see period to see what's going on. And evidently, it's, you know, you sort of fuel a fire and then you watch it burn. I think it's a very dangerous situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Marwan Krady, the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. But my sense, Marwan, is that the real agenda here, and this is a part of the demands, of course, these 13-point demands that were made, which are unrealistic and humiliating, and they basically, the Saudis and the Egyptians, General Sisi, they just want to shut down Al Jazeera. It's been driving them crazy for a long time. And on top of that, I think there's an element of spite here. I think these authoritarian leaders like Sisi and the Al Saud family basically want to say to the Arab street, you know, you had your fun with the Arab Spring, but it's over, and just deal with reality now. What's your sense?
Indeed. I mean, you know, this is the interesting thing about Algeria. So we had a couple of recent statements, one from the Saudi foreign minister, who's saying we're doing all of this not to harm Qatar, but we're doing all of this to help Qatar, right? So there's as if they're trying to force a wedge between the Qatari rulers and the people of Qatar, or Qatar as a nation. On the other hand, we have the Qatari foreign minister who said that this is nothing short of an attempt to strip sovereignty out of Qatar. And so clearly there's a very big agenda. The interesting thing about Al Jazeera is that in effect, Al Jazeera today is not the kind of threat that it used to be to the Saudis, even to the Egyptians, that it used to be, you know, whether in the late 90s, mid-2000s with Saudi Arabia, when we had Saudi dissidents on the air, live talk shows from Doha, attacking the royal family, or during the Egyptian revolution, that was part of the Arab uprisings, where Al Jazeera came out very clearly and unequivocally in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood against the Egyptian military. If you recall, when Mr. Morsi was elected, Qatar gave a $1 billion loan to Egypt. There was another billion that was supposed to materialize that never happened. And so I think what's interesting is Al Jazeera, there's definitely an element of spite. I think you put your finger on a fundamental dimension of all of this, that Al Jazeera is no longer an effective threat, but symbolically it looms very large, particularly because, you know, there was research years ago that showed that a lot of people thought that Al Jazeera and Qatar were interchangeable. So the sort of brand of Al Jazeera nearly overshadowed the brand of the country. So shutting down Al Jazeera is, in effect, taking over Qatar. So we have to understand the symbolic dimensions of this, which are, I think, much more important than the actual effective strategic threat that Al Jazeera poses to the Saudi royal family or to the current military dictatorship in Egypt.
Well, already it just seems that the logic is most of what they've said to justify this have been pretty absurd. I don't think the charges of terrorism are particularly, you know, I mean, obviously they've supported Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course Hamas being a protege of the Muslim Brotherhood, and maybe that's why Israel wants them curtailed as well. But the idea that they're somehow in bed with Iran is absurd, and in fact, Saudi Arabians are driving Qatar into the embrace of Iran, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're faced with these kinds of threats, it's no longer a political choice. It's a choice for survival. And so the fact that the Iranians and the Turks are helping Qatar right now is truly a lifeline, whether with Turkish military troops coming into Qatar. According to the Turks and the Qatari, this was agreed upon previously, before the crisis, or Iranian food shipments to Qatar. You're definitely throwing Qatar more in the arms, in the embrace of these two big regional powers. And I think in many ways, Qatar will be emerging more and more clearly as a proxy space where you have Iran and Turkey, with all their disagreements, they are more or less united on this, on one hand, and on the other hand, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So you have the four largest, most strategically important countries in the region, in addition to Israel, that are using Qatar as a proxy space to settle their scores.
Well, clearly there is a irony here in terms of who supports terrorism and who doesn't. There's quite a controversy going on now in the UK. As you know, there was a report on who funds extremism and influences extremism in the UK that followed the recent terrorist attacks, and Theresa May, under her watch as Home Secretary, this report was commissioned and then it's been held up, and now the Henry Jackson Society in the UK has issued a report saying that Saudi Arabia is the chief foreign promoter of Islamic extremism in the United Kingdom. And that's making life difficult for Theresa May. So in terms of this idea of who funds terrorism, it is pretty extraordinary that the extent to which the Trump administration seems to be totally turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's previous role, whether it's doing it now or not. You said that the Jared's forged relationship with MBS. I believe Ivanka Trump's already received $100 million for her charity. So what's going on here in terms of Muslim ban, this selectivity in terms of this tiny little Gulf nation of Qatar being blamed for terrorism when there's so much evidence that Saudi Arabia's been sponsoring it for the longest time?
Indeed. I mean, so this is a situation we have. If you look at the countries involved, the Qataris, but also the Saudis, the Turks, the Iranians, have all at different times sponsored groups, as governments, but also as individuals through donations. Because don't forget, these are countries that have a lot of very wealthy individuals whose sympathies lay with various strands of political Islamism, whether violent or not, and whether, you know, how violent and all such things. So, you know, this is where the Syrian theater becomes very important, because at various points, the Qataris and the Saudis supported various Islamist camps within the Syrian war, within the Syrian crisis. And so, obviously, to accuse Qatar alone of funding this or that group is definitely ironic. But you have to understand also that, you know, this is a very sort of rhetorical strategies that are unfolding, in the sense that different countries supporting different Islamist groups are accusing each other of terrorism, partly for domestic consumption, but also, very importantly, for consumption in Western public opinion. Because as you know, you mentioned the UK, but also in the US, political Islamism has become sort of a ballyhoo, has become sort of the big other. So invoking it in these terms allows people to score political points that find echo in London, in Washington, in Paris, not to mention Moscow, as opposed to just regionally.
Well, Maran Kredi, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show again.
And again, I've been speaking with Maran Kredi, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture, and the Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. And his latest book is The Naked Blogger of Cairo, now out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Poland's authoritarian leader has lured Donald Trump to Poland for a photo op. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Gatti, who is a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State, and his books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Gatti.
Well, hello in Los Angeles.
Thank you. And you were just in Poland, Charles Gatti, and the president is heading there. He'll be meeting with Polish authorities on Thursday. It is pretty extraordinary the extent to which Jarosław Kaczyński, who leads the ruling Law and Justice Party, is effectively being crowing to the international media. He's so proud. And he feels, believes that somehow Europe is envious that Trump is visiting him first and nobody else. And there aren't too many people around the world who are that excited about Donald Trump showing up.
Well, it seems that several countries in Europe actually would prefer him not to come there. But the Polish government has some similar views to President Trump's, particularly about the issue of sovereignty and the significance of other countries not having a say in your work or criticize it from the outside, and particularly this Polish government is reluctant to deepen European integration.
Well, knowing how sensitive Donald Trump is to criticism and how he lashes out at everybody, including Zbigniew Brzezinski's daughter, he obviously is concerned about the fact that at least 100,000 protesters are getting organized in Hamburg to confront him, and also protests are being organized in London. But there will be no protests in Poland, I take it. It'll be a love fest.
Well, I wouldn't say that. We have to wait and see whether the opposition, which is quite active in Poland, makes a difference to let President Trump know that there is another Poland as well, and the government does not represent all Poles.
Well, the same could be said of the United States, of course.
Indeed.
So tell me then about what is happening with this government and the criticism coming from European authorities and others that there's a kind of creeping authoritarianism going on in both Poland and Hungary.
Well, perhaps your listeners might be responsive to this generalization, since they are probably most familiar with what's going on in Russia, which is for all practical purposes now, once again, an authoritarian regime. So I would say that Hungary is about 3 or 4 years behind Russia, and Poland is about 3 or 4 years behind Hungary. In other words, the Hungarian regime of Viktor Orban is on its way towards authoritarianism. It calls itself an illiberal state, but I think the better way of saying it is that it has turned away from Western institutions and Western values. And the same process is underway in Poland as well, but it is not as advanced, I say advanced in quotation marks, as it is in Hungary and certainly not like in Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Gatti, who is a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State. His books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbig, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. So how then do you explain the fact that the Polish government, of course, is very nervous about Russia, and they've ponied up their 2% of NATO money. They've sent their soldiers to fight with the US-led coalition in Afghanistan. So if they're on their way to becoming like Putin's Russia, that doesn't mean they're not opposed to Putin's Russia.
Well, I should make it very clear that when it comes to the generalization that I offered, I was talking about the internal set up the internal institution, the crackdown on the constitutional court in Poland, for example, the squeezing of the Polish press, particularly of the public press, the transformation of important bureaucracies such as the foreign ministry, etc., etc. I'm not talking about Poland's outlook on the world, which remains, as it has been throughout history, significantly anti-Russian. They are very concerned. They are very supportive of NATO, together with the three Baltic states there. And as you mentioned, importantly, now their contribution has increased, and they have reached, or they're about to reach, the 2% level that NATO recommends to its members.
Well, do you think that Trump is going to step up and reinforce U.S. support for NATO's Article 5, which he was reluctant to do at the NATO summit?
Well, the indications are obvious. That I have no access to his speech that he will give in Warsaw tomorrow. But I would think it's a must for an American president after the difficulties and the criticisms that he encountered when he failed to repeat the traditional endorsement of Article 5 during his last trip in Europe. So, yes, I do expect him to say that particularly important it is in Poland and the three Baltic states.
Well, it was hardly a failure. He's standing there at the NATO summit right in front of the twisted wreckage from 9/11. And, of course, Article 5 was invoked by NATO when they sent their forces to help the U.S. out in Afghanistan. It seemed deliberate that he did not mention Article 5. I believe it was in the original speech, and that both Tillerson and General McMaster were shocked hearing live that Bannon and company and Sebastian Gorka had changed the speech.
Well, I am at a loss to interpret American foreign policy these days. You called me to talk about Poland.
Right.
And obviously you mentioned that Trump was going there. But you cannot tell what President Trump might say or do from 1 hour to the next. So I don't know why he failed to do that. Perhaps the only possible explanation, with which I totally disagree, that one interpretation, I disagree with what he did there, which was to keep other countries off balance, just as he does here in this country. And maybe that's a good commercial tactic in some cases, but it is unbecoming of a U.S. president on whose words and deeds so many countries depend.
Well, then let's talk about Poland. You were recently there. We've talked about the kind of creeping authoritarianism with the ruling party that has cracked down and captured public media, television, and is captured the Supreme Courts, I guess, the top courts, if you will, but now going after the regional courts as well. But there was an article in Wednesday's New York Times suggesting that Poland might well be not just a regional leader, but some kind of new economic model to follow. So elaborate on that.
Yes, I'll be happy to. There is a very substantial difference between the performance of the Polish economy and Polish politics. The Polish economy, while I think that article that you referred to is unduly praising the Poland, but it is largely accurate. The Polish economy is doing well. Growth rates are good. There is a gap between the well-to-do and the poor in Poland as well, but who are we in the United States to criticize them for that? That's a global phenomenon now that the middle class in terms of incomes has all but disappeared, and it's a global phenomenon. So the Polish economy is good, and the government has more or less restrained itself. And when it comes to private, the part of the economy, which is about two-thirds or maybe a little more, 70-75% of the economy is in private hands, and they have allowed them to do well. I have to tell you, as a personal impression, it was quite a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, when I was in Warsaw the last time, and I barely recognized the place. It just looked so much better, so improved. The infrastructure is better, etc., etc. It is quite an impressive thing, especially after I was in Hungary, Slovakia, many other countries in Europe, and I just did not see that economic vitality that I saw there. And that's in sharp contrast to the very rigid authoritarian government that appears to want to, not just appears to, but actually has wanted to move the opposition outside the realm of politics. And so while elections are supposed to be held, but the circumstances of the election are extremely suspicious. And so you mentioned the constitutional court that was essentially taken over. And so some of the press is free. The largest newspaper, Gazeta Wyborcza, for example, is functioning well, but under considerable pressure by the government. So there is a gap between the economy and the politics. There's a substantial difference there. And one ought to be aware of that. There is another article in the New York Times, by the way, that reports on the political realm, and that is quite critical.
And what would the difference then be between Poland and Russia in terms of the op-ed that we were talking about in the New York Times suggests that somehow Polish billionaires are more patriotic than the kleptocrats surrounding Putin? Is there an explanation?
Well, I don't think that's a significant. The significant issue is that the economy is run essentially by the by Putin, by the Kremlin in Russia. And it doesn't work well, especially because the main issue a few years ago was still, you know, natural resources, energy. And as long as the price of oil was up, the Russian economy was doing reasonably well. Now that it is down, there is nothing left there. And there are a few companies, and a couple, few of them are in private hands, and the government is trying not to interfere with that. But that's not the pattern. The pattern is that the economy is run in a centralized way, not quite as centralized as in the past, but under Soviet rule, but still pretty much that way. In Poland, this is not the case. It is not the case. The first of all, the orientation is towards the European Union. And a significant part of the Polish foreign trade, for example, is with the European Union. This is not the case with Russia.
Well, what is then the explanation for this rollback of conservatism? It's often suggested that there's a kind of tie, if you will, between the ruling party and the Catholic Church. What are the conservative organs in that state, and why would they be able to sort of turn the clock back if that's indeed what appears to be happening?
Well, democracy, contrary to our expectations, has not taken root in countries like Poland and even more so in Hungary, and not at all in Russia. There are many factors there. Humiliation would be one. The feeling, particularly strong in Russia, but also in Hungary and Poland, that they have not been able to catch up with the West. You may remember that during the communist era, let's say in the 1980s, Western broadcasts kept saying, you know, just get rid of the commies and a good life will follow. And that has not been the case. It is true that when you compare, let's say, the Polish economy with Scandinavian free economies, the gap is not quite as large as it was. But the last 10 years, that gap continued to be there. In other words, in the 1990s, changes took place. I did once a study between Austria and Hungary, for example, and it was really interesting to see how the Hungarians were trying to catch up and were catching up with Austria for about 10 years, but that has stopped. And so there is a lot of second thoughts about the nature of Western democracies. And, of course, seeing all the arguments in Parliament, the deadlock in Washington, our example is not particularly helpful.
Well, just in closing, Charles Gaddy, you mentioned that the opposition is alive and well. It's apparently the case that we know that Donald Trump has some frail ego. Even in spite of his enormous narcissism, he still wants to be loved, even though he insults people all around the place. But apparently he's found a place where he's expecting to be loved. And apparently the Law and Justice Party have promised the White House that Trump will have adoring crowds. And the ruling party is bussing in its supporters from the country all over Poland and encouraging them to take part in, quote, a great patriotic picnic. So what do you expect?
Well, I think the government will be successful to create the impression that the Polish people love Donald Trump. And he will enjoy that, as you suggest, very much. But from a political perspective, this will be the first time that an American president or a foreign minister, secretary of state, would go to one of these countries and not meet with members of the opposition. It is, in my view, outrageous that they have not scheduled a meeting yet. Now, it may be that it will happen anyway tomorrow. We have to wait and see. But for the time being, there is no plan for him to meet with distinguished people. Your listeners know his name, Donald Tusk, who is now the head of the European Union, the president of the European Union. Well, he may not be there. He's not the actual leader of the opposition, but his party is alive and reasonably well, but constantly attacked and deprived of sufficient space, for example, at advertisement, and no access to public radio or television, etc., etc. So it's people like Tusk that our president should be talking to, and he won't.
Well, Charles Gatti, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Gatti, who's a senior research professor of European and Eurasian Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's a former senior advisor with the policy planning staff of the United States Department of State, and his books include Failed Illusions, Moscow, Washington, Budapest, and the 1956 Hungarian Revolt, and Zbigniew, the Strategy and Statecraft of Zbigniew Brzezinski. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how North Korea's missile test has called Trump's bluff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Norper, a professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum at Columbia University. A former State Department senior analyst, he's held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Norper.
Thank you, Ian.
And what do you think, Stephen, is the extent to which Kim Jong-un appears to have sort of called Donald Trump's bluff? Because some time back, Donald Trump, shortly after he became president, said and vowed, if not declared, that North Korea would never have a nuclear weapon that could reach the United States. And he said bluntly, it's not going to happen. Well, the test on Tuesday, on July the 4th, hardly an accident, apparently indicates that the North Koreans could strike Alaska and Hawaii. So it is happening. It has happened. So what does Trump do now?
Well, it seems that the challenge is, again, as you state, very direct, and one that does appear to have crossed a red line, or at least certainly pushed to that. There are questions about the extent of the technology, the second stage, which qualifies it as an ICBM, appears to have flown for only a short period. But that said, it does seem to be expert opinion that it could strike Alaska, as you indicate, potentially Hawaii, as well as potentially the Pacific Northwest. And as one scientist observed, the leap from 6,800 kilometers to 10,000 is not all that great. So it indicates that they're moving very quickly indeed, and that there is a period before long when they would have the potential to strike the greater United States. in terms of the continental mess. So this is indeed a challenge for the administration, and it's one that Trump and his team will have to look at. Clearly, it was designed to send a signal not only on the U.S. Independence Day, but also in the wake of the meeting of South Korean President Moon Jae-in with Donald Trump, where they stated their resolve repeatedly, as well as in advance of the G20 meeting. So this is largely aimed at communicating a message at a time that's serious, where there may be some potential discord at the G20, and the North Koreans are experts at exploiting division and trying to further drive wedges. So there's that tactical aspect as well.
Well, Donald Trump appears to be quite angry with the Chinese, and he's tweeted out his annoyance or disappointment, I suppose, saying that instead of helping him out, essentially China's trade with North Korea has increased 40% in the first quarter of 2017.
Right, and certainly one can step back and say, well, you know, was there real reliability with the Chinese from the first place, and that perhaps there was an over-reliance on putting too much expectation on the Chinese, and that China's one security treaty partner is North Korea, and North Korea does rely on China as its lifeline, both for fuel and foodstuff. As you indicate, trade has actually increased despite the cutoff of Seoul and despite what we hear has been some internal crackdown on trading companies and some measures by Chinese banks to censure themselves or to try to decrease the level of trade with North Korea. But it seems that China feels that it is doing its most. It repeatedly says that it does that within the United Nations Security Council. It has co-sponsored the recent resolutions. It says it's cracking down, but for Washington, it doesn't appear that Beijing is doing enough.
Well, Donald Trump tweeted out after the launch, does this guy, obviously referring to Kim Jong-un, does this guy have anything better to do with his life? Perhaps China will put a heavy move on North Korea and end this nonsense once and for all. Mm-hmm. I mean, boy, that's not what we normally hear from presidents, but...
Well, it isn't, and most of this presidency has been fairly atypical, and certainly no one knows how to read the tweet communication, but it seems that maybe what is being suggested here is that China would take stronger measures in terms of the North Korean regime. No one knows exactly what that means. Does that mean pressuring Kim Jong-un, or does that mean regime change, removing Kim Jong-un and putting an administration in place that would be favorable not only to China, but perhaps to the remainder of the outside world, to include the United States. But that's fairly lofty thinking, and I don't think the Chinese analysts feel that there has been that kind of thought. And also within China, both at government levels as well as within university and think tanks, most of them feel that North Korea is there. It's problematic. This Chinese administration does not like the North Koreans, but they deal with them. They provide a strategic buffer. They provide China with some stability, and the last thing they want are refugees and the pandemics that accompany them overflowing the Yalu. They don't want anything stirring the Korean minority in northeast China. So there's a longer-term strategic view from Beijing that they can accommodate North Korea for the time being. However, that flies right in the face of North Korea's missile and nuclear development, which, by the way, puts China at tremendous risk. So the question is, when will China consider the carrying cost of North Korea to be too great?
Well, it does seem quite ironic that when this test took place, prompting Donald Trump to get angry with the Chinese, China's leader, Xi Jinping, is in Moscow, and he told the Russian media that Chinese-Russian strategic ties, quote, are at the best point in history. And the two neighbors of North Korea, China and Russia, warned that this tension could lead to an armed conflict, and they effectively chastised Trump as well as Kim Jong-un to refrain from provocative actions and warlike remarks. So they're, I guess, trying to be the adults in the room, right?
Well, from their view, they are, in the sense that Beijing has been pushing for some time now for a trade-off of the United States and South Korea, lessening the frequency of their military exercises in exchange for some sort of freeze or moratorium on North Korean nuclear and missile development. That has not been received well by Washington. And so Beijing continues to push that point. But Beijing and Moscow, on the one hand, publicly do not want to come out too far on North Korea, which has enjoyed good relations with both since the Cold War years. On the other hand, privately, they express a great deal of concern about the level of sophistication and the rapidity of the development of North Korea's missile and nuclear capabilities. So they, too, are very unhappy with it. And we've actually seen the Russians and the Chinese come around largely to regard this as a threat and regard this as a point of concern. Hopefully, they will take a more active role, whether that's encouraging North Korea to deal more responsibly with what it has, to understand doctrinal issues, to understand the benefits of nonproliferation, and hopefully, perhaps, to push North Korea to that negotiating table with the United States so that we can get some sort of decrease in tensions and a moratorium on their development.
Well, it would seem from Donald Trump's latest tweets, where he says, you know, so much for China working with us, but we had to give it a try. It seems, you know, somewhat petulant, but, you know, what do you think he's saying? What comes next? In other words, we tried the Chinese route. It didn't work. So what do we do next? I mean, you know, this is a leader that should actually make the North Koreans nervous because he is a little unpredictable. And he does operate on very personal impulses. For example, the polls have promised him a warm welcome and lavish praise, so he can't wait to go to Poland. But, you know, anybody that criticizes him, he gets, basically will cut them off. And he seems to have been very affected by this incredibly cynical, disgraceful behavior of the North Koreans sending home that American who, in a coma, who subsequently died.
Yes, I mean, the tragedy of the death of Otto Warmbier does seem to have affected many in Washington and across the country very, very strongly on a very personal level. And so there still is a demand for accountability on that part. It seems that the White House is trying to find a solution to how to address that. And then they have the broader concerns clearly in terms of the missile and nuclear development, as well as larger concerns about North Korean human rights and activity on a number of fronts that concern the international community. And so it's really a challenge of how to develop a policy that can better respond. They seem to be saying that China hasn't done enough. Yet again, they're also continuing to push China. And it seems that the combination of Defense Secretary Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson, and National Security Advisor McMaster are urging a strong, forceful process that includes things like deterrence and a tightening of financial sanctions, perhaps to include secondary sanctions. And that may be what Trump is alluding to as well, that the U.S. will begin to more significantly impose secondary sanctions, which the Chinese certainly don't want. And we saw a step in that direction with the closure of the Bank of Dandong. So there may be more along the way. And clearly, we also have to see what happens with this afternoon's meeting on the National Security Council and what type of statement is issued, and that will certainly condition the next steps forward among Washington, Beijing, Tokyo, Moscow, and Seoul in trying to address this crisis.
Well, there's been some talk of a surgical strike and a decapitation strike, both of which apparently would result in massive collateral damage, not to mention perhaps the Seoul being wiped out. And I can't imagine that the South Korean capital could be evacuated. If indeed it were evacuated, that might well trigger a North Korean preemption. So militarily, this seems like an absolutely impossible situation. And I wonder, you know, we both take comfort from the fact that there are some adults in the room with General McMaster and General Mattis in this administration, but they're both generals. And so I'm trying to figure out here whether, Stephen Norfolk, whether we should be relieved that there are a couple of sober adults in that very ideological, you know, he's got people like Bannon and Sebastian Gorka advising him, apparently. But he also has McMaster and Mattis restraining him. But on the other hand, they are generals. And, you know, to generals, everything looks like a nail and they carry a hammer.
Perhaps, but there's also an alternative view that I would tend to lean toward, which is that it's the generals who also know the greatest cost of conflict. And so they know what this means in terms of the cost of life, in terms of the cost of life relative to U.S. forces stationed in Korea and Japan, as well as the much broader population, South Korean and American and other expatriates. And they know the seriousness of the U.S. obligation to its ally, South Korea. They have been working, the military have been working very strongly with both Japan and South Korea on trilateral coordination. And clearly, the commander of U.S. Forces, Korea Combined Forces Command, United Nations Command, Vincent Brooks, has also, you know, echoed that line. They're ready, and readiness is their primary objective, but they, being the senior-most military that you've mentioned, are ones who will caution the president on what the real cost is. That doesn't question their willingness to take the fight, but I think that they may well be a moderating force, and clearly the preference through the National Security Council review was toward tighter financial sanctions and a step up in deterrent capability. And what we need to see now really is a step up in diplomacy. We need to figure out a way to that negotiating table very soon because of this rapidly expanding technological capability on the part of the North Koreans.
But Stephen Norpa, when you talk about stepping up diplomacy, we don't even have an ambassador to South Korea.
Right, and that ambassador, and there have been, you know, some very serious names floated, and Washington does need to get that individual in place rapidly, as well as an assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific. We need all of the players in place to help, and to help in particular in terms of crisis prevention. My concern really is one about miscalculation and misreads, miscommunications that can lead to conflict. And the escalatory nature on the peninsula is one where you go from little to a great amount very, very quickly. And so we need sound minds in place, and we really need to try to figure out a way to open channels of communication. The New York channel, meaning the channel between North Korea and the United States through the mission of the DPRK in New York, has been cut off since last July. The hotlines between North and South Korea were cut off under the former President Park Geun-hye in 2016. We need to make sure that all communication channels are open so that in the event of a step up in perceived hostilities, that there can be some talk, especially between and among military officials, so that we can find ways to lessen tension rapidly and not find ourselves in a situation where we're dealing with tragic actions that can have stark consequences.
Well, just in closing, though, obviously, a lot of our leaders, particularly George W. Bush, vented his disgust at the North Korean regime. But at the end of the day, after you've said how dreadful they are, you still have to deal with them. They're not going away. And it seems to me that Donald Trump has raised the bar even further by talking about, you know, the possibility of a real war. And I just don't know. It's one thing to back down from calling Kim, you know, all kinds of names. It's another thing to back down from saying that there might be a war. You're not worried about that?
Oh, of course. I think all of us that have been involved in this, and I've been doing this for most of 30 years, are extremely concerned. This is the highest level of tensions that we've seen. The last that we can remember is the nuclear crisis of 1993-94 that led to the agreed framework, and really the entire scholarly community, and I believe a great number in the policy community, are very much on edge here. So we're trying to think of creative solutions. People are trying to maintain contacts. There has been a push for unofficial dialogue. People are looking at ways that they can reapproach and try to wind down the situation and at least try to lower the bar a few levels. But perhaps with the type of dialogue and back and forth that you're describing, and you're describing an unpredictable nature in both Pyongyang and in Washington, that may necessitate meetings. We may have to think of bold gestures, and there may have to be some sort of summit or bold meeting that gets Kim Jong-un in, whether that is facilitated by Putin, whether that is facilitated by Xi Jinping, whether that involves Donald Trump, Abe, or let's remember the inter-Korean dynamic, the new very talented President Moon Jae-in, who has thought about unification for many, many years and served as a chief of staff under one Sunshine President, Noh Moo-hyun, and who has spent 10 years thinking about governance, has come in with some very strong feelings about how to approach the North. And so it behooves the international community to encourage inter-Korean contact and ultimately inter-Korean resolution to this very stark crisis. And that may help lead the international community forward as well.
Right. I recall that the crisis that you talked about under Clinton, Jimmy Carter stepped in there, didn't he?
Well, he did. Jimmy Carter played a visit, but the negotiation process played out in Geneva. And former ambassadors Robert Gallucci and Thomas Hubbard negotiated that agreement. And that basically set a hold on North Korea's nuclear development, at least as outlined, for most of 8 or 9 years. And it was then in 2002 that we found out about the highly enriched uranium capability. But you're right in terms of the perpetual nature of this and trying to realize that we've had now four presidencies where they have had to deal with this very, very stark challenge of North Korea means that we have to start striking at real solutions, because we appear to be moving in a direction on a trajectory that is not healthy and will not achieve peace and security unless we think boldly and unless we encourage real movement to the negotiating table. And that is going to require trade-offs from all parties involved. But we need to try to find an interest, find a way in the interest of non-proliferation, in the interest of seeking to stem nuclear weapons development. And the challenge this means for even the greater nuclear development, the nuclear proliferation regime. And so this needs to be resolved, and resolved very quickly, because the threat is growing and it is a very clear and present danger.
Well, Stephen Norper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Norper, who's a professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum at Columbia University, a former State Department senior analyst. He's held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and producer Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.